You know, it's an exercise in radical empathy, but it brings you to the coalface of their experience.
Welcome to the Circle Holding Podcast with me, Julia Davis.
And me, Tessa Venuti Sanderson. We are the co-authors of the book Circle Holding, A Practical Guide to Facilitating Talking Circles.
We would love for you to join us for free talks, question and answer sessions, all about the art of holding circle. You can find these at circleholding.org. So today this is Julia speaking rather than Tessa, and I'm in conversation with Lee Keelock. And Lee is one of the people who was there right at the very beginning of an organization called Narrative 4 that does a very, very specific type of circle holding work. Welcome, Lee. It's really good to have you with us here.
Julia, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So what I'd love to do is dive straight in to your origin story, really. I'd love to hear how Narrative 4 came about.
Well, there's sort of two parallel origin stories. The original story is Lisa Consiglio and Colm McCann, who's the writer, the Irish writer, got together and they sort of corralled a bunch of global authors and they met and they sort of tried out this method of the story exchange, which I'll explain in a minute. And they sort of they wrestled with the question of what is the highest aim of storytelling, and these are sort of global authors that that took it upon. So they were sort of tricked into this story exchange method that Lisa dreamed up, and one of the writers, Ron Rash from the South in the US in the South, he said, "All right, now you've split the atom. What are you going to do with it?" And then sort of fast forward a few months, my own sort of origin story into Narrative 4. When I met Colm McCann and Lisa, I was a teacher in the US. I'm originally from England, from Maldon in Essex. And I emigrated to the US and I started teaching in Connecticut in a town called Newtown, which is where Sandy Hook is. And if anyone knows anything about Sandy Hook, the you know, one of the signature horrors of our time in the last decade was the mass shootings in our town. And the you know, in response, and Julia, this is in hindsight, I wasn't thinking this clear at the time. But at the time, I just wanted to see how I could help my students in my classroom. I was an English teacher, how I could help them heal or start the healing process. We were a traumatized community. And, you know, I stumbled upon Colm McCann's work. I stumbled upon a book that he'd written called Let the Great World Spin. I thought it would be a book that could help my students heal. It sort of broke the traditional curriculum. We sort of stepped outside of the traditional curriculum because there was nothing traditional that would work after a trauma like that in our community. So I wanted to use story for my students to... So they didn't have to be sort of defined by a single narrative anymore, which was the gun violence in our town. Fast forward 3 months, and then I met Colm. We had a beer, we had a pint, and he visited Newtown, and he spoke with some of the students, and he told me of this Narrative 4 methodology, the story exchange. And I was sort of intrigued by it, and so I tried it in my class with my students, and all of a sudden, this mosaic of stories happened. All of a sudden, they didn't have to sort of focus on the single narrative of that one day. They were made up of many, many more stories. So to be honest, I still feel like I'm an imposter. I was sort of thrust into this circle work, you know, by default. But now here we are 10 years later, and it underscores the need for our stories, for anybody on the planet to share a story, to be seen, to be heard, to be validated. So would you like me to explain the story exchange method for the audience?
Yeah, I think that would be really interesting because you've already kind of talked about the fact that it involves somebody telling a story and being heard in a normal story, you know, circle setting. We try and set the stage for people to be able to speak uninterrupted, but there's something very different about the story exchange. It's that word exchange that, you know, happens with your particular methodology. So I'd love for you to talk about that.
Yeah. And you can blame the artists. We're an artist-founded organization. So they were sort of disturbing the universe with their vision, right? Like, how can we use stories? What is the highest aim of storytelling? How can we sort of dismantle some of the traditional storytelling, the ways to tell stories? So they came up with this idea that involves the notion of radical empathy. And so if you and I, Julia, were partnered, I would tell you a story from my life, right? Any story could be as fun as you want it to be, embarrassing. It could be, you know, sad. And you would do the same. You would tell me a story from your life. But then we come back into a circle where there's about 8 to 10 people, and you sit next to your partner, and I have to retell your story in the first person as if it's my own. So I would begin by saying, hi, my name is Julia, and I'm going to tell you a story about XYZ. And then you would do the same. There's no interruption while people are telling the stories. There's a reflection period at the end where we sort of discuss the process, the emotions inherent in that. But it's a radical act to take on somebody else's story. I always think of it like you have to dethrone yourself from the center of your own universe or world and put somebody else there. And, you know, it's an exercise in radical empathy. Obviously, you don't live the experience of somebody else, but it brings you to the coalface of their experience, right? It brings you as close as you can get to their lived experience, or at least the emotional content of their lived experience.
Because there's a very big difference emotionally as a storyteller to telling that story back to the person who said it to you and having them listen, and having that in a group context where you're in circle with more people. That's like telling their story to other people. So could you talk to that? Could you talk to why you would choose to bring it to a circle rather than maintain that little pod of two people?
Yeah. Well, I think personally, we think storytelling is this shared experience, and it's sort of campfire stuff, right? The more people, the more stories, the more people that get brought into proximity with each other, the more chance there is for sort of change. We bring a lot of communities together that never have a chance to meet. So we think that hearing more stories, you know, there's more of an opportunity to shift your perspective, to sort of transform ideas, and rather than just the two people in the original pair share. So really, it's about community. It's about bringing people into community, and that often takes more than two people, you know?
Yeah. So there's a level of jeopardy in this. I think you said that there's a level of jeopardy involved in listening to someone's story and sharing it with others. Most of us aren't used to listening in a really, really deep way. And one of the challenges that come up, and actually we did a recent share in a facilitation that we did, and this was something that occurred. And I think it took all of our co-circle facilitation skills to manage it. When somebody shares a story, and then when you feedback and the person whose story was shared, they didn't hear their story. And I just want to hear from your perspective how that would be managed. I'm sure you've done, you know, I'm sure it's happened yeah. more times than once for you. I haven't shared that many times, so this was our first experience of it.
Yeah, it's tricky. And I mean, there's so many levels. It seems so simple on the surface. You tell a story, you retell a story in the first person, right? But you have your partner sitting next to you, right? So you're holding their story. One, I worked with a guy, Warren Hardy, in Hartford in Connecticut. He works with kids in gangs. And I remember him, right, that he was facilitating, and he told the kids, he's like, look, it's like somebody walking up to you and handing you their baby and then walking away. And you're responsible for this child, right? For the raising of this child, the nurturing this. And that's the gravity of what we're asking people to do. I don't want to sort of scare people away, but so the way I sort of look at it is, yes, those things happen. those things definitely happen. I don't think they happen as often as we think they would, right? People aren't used to listening. We're terrible listeners in general, right? Just think about your own life and the way you listen or don't listen and how you get distracted. And there's all these things sort of vying for our attention. So we slow people down. We get them to, it's a practice, right? Listening is a practice. We sort of upfront that with people. So you're not going to get everything right if you just capture the essence of somebody's story. So the empathy process is not just about the retelling. It's about the minute you walk into that room, right? That space, and you're being courageous just to cross that line and walk in with others and say, we're going to do this. We're going to do it, give it our best shot. Right. So there's a generosity in that I think we have to take into account. Nobody's intent is to ruin somebody's story. So we sort of talk about those things, and you know, before we sort of pair people up. The other thing is sometimes the stories we tell ourselves, we've told it a certain way for so long that we only hear it one way. And when somebody else holds your story, they're going to hear something. They're going to bring their own lived experience to that union. And so sometimes they can hear something different in your story, or they might hear the humor in your story that you didn't see, or the tragedy in a moment. And sometimes when that's articulated back, people are like, well, that's not what I meant, or that's not how I see it. And so there's this element of there's a meta moment in the reflection where the actual storyteller, the original storyteller, has to do some work too and say, well, I wonder, I've never really thought about hearing my story that way. I never sort of captured that or so I don't know. There's a lot of it's complicated, right? It really, facilitation is key. You have to have a facilitator that's trained that can sort of handle that emotional space. And but most of the time, even if there is a sort of moment that's a little tense, right? Most of the time, we are more than capable to handle it, all of us in that space together. You know, I've never seen it really fall apart.
You can write a book about circle holding and still be on a lifelong journey of holding space for people. And I very much put myself in that space. I am never done. I've always got something to learn. And sometimes I believe I feel like I'm right at the very beginning. Again, there are days where you're like, oh my goodness, do I even know how to do this? What we did in that circumstance is we had space, we had time, we had a whole weekend. And this was somewhere in the middle of that weekend. So people had already spent time together. And we gave the person who felt that the opportunity to kind of put us right and retell their story in the way, or like say what they wanted to say. Would you say that's right or wrong? Or, what would you say about that?
I would say your instinct is correct. I mean, you have to have empathy for everybody in that room, right? So you don't want to single out a storyteller, right, who's trying their best and that maybe they did mess it up, right? I think the instinct is correct. So for you to say and acknowledge, right, that person can say, well, what parts of the story do you really want us to walk away with? What parts are really important to you? That was perfect, what you did. That's all it takes sometimes. That's it.
Yeah. And I think we were very clear. We tried very much also to validate the storyteller. Mm-hmm. And talk, you know, and reiterate how hard it is to do that. I think a takeaway from me from what you've said is that just giving people the opportunity, the person who's listening to their own story, to say, well, how, you know, it may not have been the story that you thought was going to be said, but what about the bit, you know, are there any bits in it that sounded interesting to you as a story? So thank you for that. It was hot, like doing it was great. And like you said, we listened to lots of different stories and we had a very particular theme for the weekend, which was lovely. But the weight of responsibility felt very different to the weight of responsibility in other circles that I've held. And it made a difference for us, I think, that there were two of us. Is that in the narrative four framework, would you more often than not have two facilitators? It would be something that would be two people.
Our best practice is a co-facilitator. And so you have a facilitator leading the circle and sort of running the show, and then you have a co-facilitator to sort of hop in, pay attention to the emotional space, the room, look around, and if somebody needs a timeout and they need to take space for themselves, that person, the co-facilitator, can always check in with that individual. So you're not stopping the flow necessarily. It's better to have two people. You see different things. But there's a couple of things I want to say too about this work. Like, you know, that when I come into a lot of communities, and when people hear the word, oh, story circle or circle work or whatever people want to call it, there's this inherent attitude that it's just a soft skill. It's very sort of woo-woo, you know, kumbaya. And there is nothing weak or about it. It is a very muscular skill. It is a very courageous thing to walk into a space and tell your story and hold somebody else's story. So anyone thinking that this is easy is just wrong. Empathy is tough. It's a tough business. And the other thing is, you know, as a facilitator, it's one of those things where you have to practice. It's one of those skills. You can't learn it from a book. You have to practice. You have to make mistakes. But that's where we learn, right? In that space of doubt and vulnerability. I feel like that's where we do most of our learning occurs. So you're just better at handling it in the end. So give yourself have some meepathy, empathy for yourself.
Thank you. I'd love to ask a couple of questions. You've done some very special work with Circle Holding as an organization. You kind of, from the inception, you talked about your own story. You've gone to some very hard places and some communities have really experienced very, very difficult things in your work, and that's been intentional. And you've also mentioned to me, you've been around for 10 years, and it is often the case when people go to those hard places that burnout occurs, because of the, you know, you've already said as well, this is emotional work. This isn't a soft skill. This is a hard skill. These are all things which show, there's like a red light bleeping at me going, this can cause burnout. So what I'd love to know is, you know, because I've looked at your organization and I've seen how skillfully it's been jigsawed together, I can see how robust it is. But I'd love for you to talk about that, about how you kind of put the structure together to allow for it to be building at year 10 rather than imploding in year 10.
Yeah, well, just a note on, yes, there is burnout. You can have facilitator burnout quite easily. If we wouldn't tell people to do story exchanges every week, you know, one after the other. You have to be mindful of your own emotional needs too. We have community. We have a massive community, global community. We are in, you know, connection with each other all the time. So just that alone, being part of that community, helps with the burnout factor, right? And you can sort of lift each other up. So there's that. But I will say about 70% of our work is done in schools and communities. We work with young adults. You know, our org is about equipping young people to sort of harness the power of stories to drive change, positive change in their communities. We want to break down stereotypes. We want to shatter stereotypes and, you know, and present people as they are. So that this is our intent. And we work with young people, and they're much more open sometimes than adults, to be honest. Like, we go in, they'll be like, all right, I'll tell a story. We'll tell a story. And we're trying to make the prompts anchored in joy and, you know, people who believed in you. Tell a story about somebody who believed in you, an act of compassion. And these kids will tell funny stories. So it's not always heavy. I don't want people to get the wrong idea. However, about when we wrote our strategic plan in the first year of our sort of organization's birth, the one of the things we wrote into our plan was that we have to be wild. We're an artist-driven organization, right? We have to stay a little wild. And so we do story exchanges where we intentionally bring very controversial communities or groups. I don't mean the groups are controversial, but that the media around it could be. So for example, guns and empathy. We did a huge thing where we were trying to tackle gun violence. The stories around gun violence or gun control or gun, you know, or sort of the banning of guns in America is a very controversial and contentious issue. And it's often presented in the media as a as an either or. Either we have guns or we don't. That's it. But that's not how it shows up in the US. So we brought 16 people together, and they were all on different wavelengths when it came to guns. Some had lost their kids, so they were sort of anti-gun, which is the worst loss that you could imagine, right? Some people were pro-gun. Some people had ran gun auction sites in the US where you didn't even have to have ID to buy a gun. We had police officers in the room. We had a lady in a wheelchair who packed a Colt 45 in her handbag because she, in her area, she couldn't protect herself. She had two prosthetic legs. And, you know, so these are the stories you don't hear in the US. It's not a simple matter, right? You have people living in Montana and have to worry about grizzly bears. You know, how do you protect yourself? You're not going to do that with your handbag, right? And so when we bring folks together, so we've tried things and we've tried to see, can you have people on different ends of a spectrum empathize? And what we learned is that it's not about changing people's minds. It's about bringing people into a space and finding common ground. Like ultimately every single person, what I walked away with in that circle, every single person in that room wanted to protect themselves or protect their family. And they just had different ideas about how to do it. So, you know, that's a starting point now for a conversation, right? Okay, so we all love our kids. We all love our family, want to protect them. Let's start with that. Let's start there. That's what we've unearthed here. We're not coming at it from these cliche sort of, you know, sound bites that we often have ready to go, right? And then we work with police and youth in communities to improve community policing. We've worked with, Arabs and Jews in the Middle East. We've brought kids, you know, so what we're doing is trying to dismantle these caricatures or these one-dimensional looks at people. And it's not always pretty, but it mostly works. And now these people are in community together. We brought people into community who would never have, walked towards each other pre-narrative four, for example. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but we do tons of, we try to bring groups together that often don't have a chance to meet. And sometimes those groups are literally a mile apart.
And when you do that, where does the continuity of care come in? Because you might come and do a story exchange, but if you do a story exchange and then you walk away from it, that's a step. But is there continuity of care with that community after that step's been taken? Or how do you map? You know, because you can have an amazing revelationary experience and then you can go back to posting horror on Instagram afterwards because you've kind of forgotten about that relationship that you built the day before.
Well, I think because our method, yes, that's possible, right? We can't curate for all of those things, but I have never in my, I'm touching wood here. I have never in my 11 years doing this work seen anybody post anything. And I'm talking about kids too, who are social media gurus, right? They're out there. They're like, everything goes live and public. I can't believe some of the things that, I mean, ordinarily that kids write, you know? And there's almost a self-policing around, because you've had to take on the story of another and you've had to embody that story and feel that story and you know, wrestle with that story. It's almost like you have this umbilical cord between you and your partner, you know, and you don't want to hurt them. So it's like, I don't see it happen. Yes, people can go back to their worlds and, you know, and can fall back into these sort of old narratives. But I guarantee you that most people that walk out of a story exchange, it makes them think twice, or it makes them have a meta moment before they post something to say, oh, how would that land on my, you know, a community where like the partner I had, like in their community, if I said it that way, maybe they're more careful about how they say things. For example, Carolyn Tuft is a lady that I love, and she lost her daughter in a mass shooting in a mall. She herself was shot. And Todd Underwood was a very vilified figure in America because he sold guns on an auction site, and he was sort of misrepresented to the American public, and he became a pariah. And so I paired them intentionally together for this Guns and Empathy. And What happened was, this is, you know, the fate, they were an age where they're into Facebook, right? We're Facebookers at our age, my age. And all of a sudden, two communities that had never been in connection, because Todd has a massive following and so does Carolyn, they would end up conversing on Facebook. And I saw Todd Underwood write once in one of his comments when somebody was getting a little rambunctious towards one of the sort of anti-gun people. And he said, hey, he's like, watch your tone. He's like, these are people we're trying to have conversation with. And let's watch our tone. It's not about, let's try and find out and be more understand. Let's listen to what they're trying to say. I've seen that sort of rhetoric. Maybe that wouldn't have happened a month earlier if he hadn't have had that experience. I don't know. Maybe they're just sound bites people fire at each other, right? So it does change. It does change people's attitude. You know, it makes
the world that we're living, yeah. So the world we're living in now, it gives me a lot of hope where maybe there was very little. So it's, you know, it's really hopeful to hear what you're saying. From that, I think this might go back to your origin story, because you need to have mechanisms of being able to do that and to make, you know, allow these things to happen. To, you know, you've talked about various communities that you've brought together. And it's great that that's occurred, but there might be people listening thinking, my goodness, how could that occur? Like, how do you bring, you know, Arabs and Jews together? How do you bring gun people who want guns and people who don't want guns together? And I'm thinking maybe some of that comes from the fact that you kind of dug deep roots at the beginning, and you had funding and you had, you know, like robust ways to go out into these communities. I'd love to know kind of how you've managed to do those things with communities. You know, how has that come about? It's, you know, different to just going into a school and saying, right, let's do a story exchange in an English class.
Well, in school they're sort of voluntold, right? Let's do this, and they're kind of like, we're going to do this. But the well, first of all, it's voluntary, right? Most of the time, my work in communities is voluntary. It's an invitation for people to show up and do this thing, right, with us. We're not forcing anyone. We don't force people to tell stories. You get to curate your own story. But the other thing is, we work very closely with, we never go into a community and say, we're narrative four, this is how we do it, let's do this. We work with local people on the ground, people who already have trust in the community. So we work with ministers, or, you know, in church groups. Got my friend Warren, who works with gang kids. I could never go in front of a bunch of kids that are sort of at risk and say, look, I'm Lee, you don't know me, but let's do this. No, but if Warren walks into that space, he can do it because he's already gained their trust. So you have to work very close. You have to identify people in the community who are change makers, who are sort of visionaries already, who are curious. That's how we do it. And then we work with those individuals and we listen to them and we say, how do you think this could show up in your community or be beneficial? And then we build a program around the needs of the locality, right? Of the locale. And we're really good listeners. We don't go in with a preset idea of how we think it's going to go. And usually the success because of that is there's buy-in. There's much more buy-in.
And is that to an outreach program, or have you got like an, I know you've kind of just launched in the UK. So how does that begin? How does that process begin? How do you make contact with these communities?
Well, the beauty of this work, well, first of all, now that we're 10 years old, we get big stories here and there. We you can look at our website, see some of our media. We were just on the Today Show in America, which is like this show that millions of people watch every morning. And we had a 10-minute bit on it because they heard about some of our work in schools and they wanted to feature us. So right then the telephone will ring off the hook right after that. So we're lucky. We have this artist network who can tweet things out. I worked with Lady Gaga once on a story exchange, and she tweets, they tweet something now and it hits 10 million people. If I tweet, it hits 10, you know, so there's that part of it. But we walk into schools, we find teachers in those schools, and we say, you seem like somebody who's innovative and a bit of a wild one. How about like taking on this method? And we just sort of, we get in through the back door, if that makes sense. We don't take conventional means sometimes. We just identify people and look around and Google. And like anyone else, we just Google what's happening in an area and find those people that can sort of do the work, you know. But yeah, it's hard. You corral. When we first did narrative for work, story work, I just found 5-10 teachers that I knew personally myself, and I was like, listen, will you try this with me and let's do this? And that's how it worked, and that's what happens. And then, you know, good work sort of builds on itself after a while. And the beauty is, if you involve youth and youth start talking about the thing that you're doing, all of a sudden it catches fire, you know, because that's where the true heart is. We've got to offload teachers and build student leadership. And the students, once they talk about it, it's hard for people to not listen, you know?
Yeah. And have you always had external funding? Is that the way that it's worked, is through external, you know, like you kind of started with a fund base?
Yeah, we've had angel investors. We've had a couple of foundations. Jackie Bezos was one of our big angel investors at the beginning, from the Bezos Family Foundation. So yes, we've had funding, but we also had to be smart, right? We had to sort of think about earned revenue streams, and we can't just sort of rely on the compassion of others all the time. So, you know, a lot of our training and a lot of our work now is available to people, and there's a small fee just to have earned revenue, so that we can, we're sort of like Robin Hood. I'll use the English reference, right? We're like Robin Hood. We take from people that can afford it, and we sort of give it to, and we bring it to communities that are far more marginalized. So, you know, there's a balance. Nobody is denied the story exchange methodology with us.
If someone starts, so we have a lot of people come to us and they're just starting out. They're thinking like, I want to do something. I want to create a circle. I want to feel listened to. I want to feel that I can be an ear for someone else. Have you got a piece of advice that you would give to them?
Yeah, I would say do it. Take a risk. You know, my whole life has been about risk taking. It's about saying yes, actually. Yes is one of the most, it's the most powerful word on the planet, right? Is to say yes to something, because it opens up doorways that you didn't, you know, you'd never sort of previously thought about. And I would say that if you're going to do, I mean, narrative for work, right? We have all the resources available for you. We have the training. You can join any story exchange for free on our website. You can just, you know, you can join one, see if you're even interested, and then watch how other people do it. And, you know, and then sort of join a couple of story exchanges and observe, and then maybe co-facilitate one day, just practice, you know. And then nobody ever feels ready. I don't think nobody ever feels 100% ready. So you have to, again, you have to live in that space. For me, you have to live in a space of doubt. I have to be, because that's where I learn the most. I don't want my brain to atrophy. I got to take a risk. I got to feel uncomfortable. I don't mind discomfort, you know?
Yeah.
The other thing I'll say is I'm never flippant about any of that stuff. I may not sound it, but I'm pretty humble. Like, I have an intellectual curiosity. I'm pretty humble when I go into a space. I really listen to understand. I don't listen to respond. I think I'm a much better listener now than I ever was. And that's at the core, you know, listen and learn from others. Be open-armed.
I've loved finding you. I am really extremely impressed by the way that your organization has built, and also the individual contributions of all the people that are involved. It really feels like a collegiate organization, and I would encourage anyone to pop in like I did and have a go at what you're doing. So thank you so much for your time. Every time I speak to you, it is another learning.
Likewise.
You can find out that we've got Lee's Pearls of Wisdom within our Circle Holding book, but also you're going to be able to find out a lot more about Narrative 4 if you just take a little look at the notes from the podcast. So thank you so much for joining me, Lee, and I look forward to Narrative for continuing to go from strength to strength.
Well, we're coming to the UK, Julia, so we'll be able to meet in person instead of these little Zoom screens. And I'm looking forward to, you know, piloting our rollout. It's happening right now. So if anyone wants to get involved, just go to info@narrative4.com. And we're going to be in England.
I'm looking forward to seeing you then.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Circle Holding podcast. I've been Tessa Venuti Sanderson.
And I've been Julia Davis. We would love for you to rate and review this podcast. A 5-star rating means more people will find us.
We're the co-authors of the book Circle Holding, A Practical Guide to Facilitating Talking Circles.
Thank you for joining us today.
You can find our trainings at circleholding.org. We hope that you find a community where you can be authentically you very soon.